Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
So welcome, I'm Karen Peter, and this is Common Grounds, where we are having conversations about the liturgical or Christian calendar. And as a part of our ordinary time observance, we're taking the opportunity to interview Art Smith today about how Community of Christ worships in different parts of the world. Now, Art has had opportunity to travel to many countries in his service to Community of Christ, including Tahiti, Central and South America, and the Caribbean. Art is a full-time minister with Community of Christ. If you've been listening to the Project Zion podcasts all along, you already know Art from previous conversations. He is currently serving as an apostle and member of the Council of 12, and we're really happy to be talking with him today. So welcome, Art.
Thanks, Karen. It's really fun to be back with my friends on Common Ground.
Well, let's see.
And Project Zion.
And you are drinking your water here at lunchtime from the appropriate Project Zion podcast mug. And so if you're listening online, hopefully you'll see a photo of Art with his.
I feel so cool now. I have Project Zion swag as of like 2 days. So this makes me feel very special.
Very awesome.
Very hip. Much hipper than I actually am.
Well, that's good. So can you tell us, other than being hip today with your mug, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So, sure. So I am, I'm Canadian, and I am married. I have been married to my wonderful, patient and supportive companion, Laura, for coming up on 26 years next week. And we have two children, Eric and Tiona. And Eric is 19, and Tiona is just about to celebrate her 11th birthday. Tiona's very excited about going to middle school next year. So that's our kind of one of our latest adventures. And we've been getting used to Eric being kind of away from home. Eric's been living in Canada since September. And we really miss having Eric around, but are grateful for things like FaceTime and that sort of stuff. So, but
and
yeah.
Facebook, of which you are a professional user of Facebook.
Some people have called me the Facebook apostle. And I don't know. I tell people I try to stay off Facebook, but I don't succeed. So yeah, Facebook is amazing. I mean, there's something, I actually was reluctant to get started on Facebook. My mother actually got me hooked. She literally walked me through signing up for Facebook, and then I forgot my password and time went by. And anyway, little by little, I started getting messages from long lost old friends, and one thing led to another. And I've discovered that it's a wonderful way in, you know, for me in Community of Christ, where community is so important. It's in my DNA. Facebook kind of just feeds that, that craving for being connected with people. And so, yeah, I love social media. I mostly just love it. Yeah.
And it shows. So today, we are talking about worship because this is Common Grounds, where that's our focus. And we're going to talk a little bit about how Community of Christ worships, or how worship looks and feels and is experienced around the world. So you did say you were Canadian. So let's start there in Canada and tell us a little bit about what worship was like when you were growing up and maybe what it's like today.
So I grew up going to the Ottawa, Canada congregation. I actually lived in West Quebec, where people speak French, but we trekked across every time the church doors were open to the Ottawa congregation. And back in those days, you know, worship was fairly cookie cutter in my experience in terms of our Sunday worship in the Ottawa congregation. In fact, I remember, you know, there was kind of a typed sheet that had sort of your standard elements of what was then what was then the RLDS worship format. So with a prelude and a welcome call to worship, opening hymn, invocation, another hymn, an offering, a sermon. I forget exactly, but I mean, this was basically it. And people would occasionally worship planning consisted of assigning people. Someone was a preacher. Someone was an assister. There was a keyboard player, and those people would maybe gather before the service downstairs and make sure that everybody knew what every person was doing. And that was the extent of worship planning. And there was a tie rack, at the top of the stairs from the basement, before you went out onto the rostrum of the congregation. And I kid you not, there were ties hanging there just in case the men, because they were all men for the most part back then, in case one of the men heading out onto the rostrum found himself in the terrifying situation of not having a tie on, he could grab one and quickly fix it there before heading out onto the rostrum. But so worship, when I was very young in Ottawa, as I recall, was a pretty cookie cutter kind of a venture. And then through the 1980s, when I was getting older, but still a kid, the church started really getting more into trying to take worship planning seriously and inject more discernment and creativity into the preparation for each individual worship service. And we formed these worship planning, well, worship commissions, we called them. But worship planning, our congregation had a worship planning team. And in the coolness of the Ottawa congregation where I was growing up, I don't know if this was the same everywhere, but I was a teenager on that congregation worship planning team. And so, we started paying more attention to, the special days on the calendar, especially, you know, things like Easter and Christmas, but also as we were learning more about some of the other, liturgical, calendar, moments. So Advent became something that was important. And so we would really spend some more time preparing those kinds of special services. But yeah, it started out very rudimentary, but it got more into with, you know, more responsive readings and special music and especially, I mean, I guess just more intentional thought and discernment going into planning those worship services.
Which then changes the experience.
It changes
coming together.
Changes the experience. It's funny. I'm not sure how much, you know, in some ways you might still end up with a worship service that on the outside didn't look all that different, but even just having participated in the whole process, it began to feel different, I think. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite hymn from growing up?
I think my favorite hymn growing up was my brother's favorite hymn, and it was probably number one, in the old, gray hymn book, which was, oh my goodness. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. We'll let you think of it.
I can't tell you what it is now.
So mine was, Lord, lift me up and let me stand by faith on heaven's table land. It's not, it hasn't been in our last two hymnals, but it was my favorite.
It's driving me crazy trying to remember that hymn number one.
Was this My Father's World? Was that?
No. Uh-oh. And we don't even have it anymore. But now, so my favorite hymn now, I always say, is Great and Marvelous. And partly because I love it, you know, I love it in Spanish. So any hymn that begins with the word estupendas, is a good hymn.
I agree. So you grew up in Canada and experienced worship there. Canada is now part of the area that you serve as your field assignment. So has worship changed in Canada?
worship has changed and is changing. So these days, there's a variety. You know, some of the congregations that I would go to would have worship that would look a lot like it did when I was a kid. And then on the other hand, you've got expressions like we have this community place ministry that they're meeting using Zoom on the internet. And so people log in and participate in worship from all sorts of remote locations, college dorm rooms, or different places around the Canada East Mission or around Canada or even around the world. And so worship becomes, you know, these faces on a computer, a TV screen. And until I started experiencing that with them, I might have been skeptical about, you know, was this really worship? Can it even be mentioned in the same conversation as this? But they have really found ways to explore worship together in an interactive, in a very spiritual kind of way, and even kind of sharing in an agape meal, where in all their remote locations, at a certain point in the service, people will break bread and eat, and so there's a yeah, worship now, it's ever evolving.
Wonderful. So we'll go from the northern reaches of, or the, in the States, maybe we think the frozen tundra of Canada. And your assignment has taken you some really interesting places, including you have worshipped in Haiti, and there's a connection between Haiti and a congregation in Canada. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, so about the time I was on the worship commission for the Ottawa congregation, we started, our youth group started making these fairly regular trips back and forth to Montreal, which is a couple of hours up the road from Ottawa. And in Montreal, we had had a fellow who was an elder in the church in Haiti move to Montreal and with his family, and then he started a congregation there. So we would go and visit this congregation, really mostly of Haitian expats in Montreal. And so I went from this, you know, where from my perspective, very limited perspective, worship was, you know, this cookie cutter, fill in the names on the program, you know, and worship always looked pretty much the same way thing, to Montreal, where it was just this very different kind of worship, where you know, people didn't all arrive. People kind of gradually arrived into the service, and so the service would start with a few people there, and then gradually grow in terms of the number of people and the energy, and things like, and I've talked before about mighty prayer, you know, where they the pastor starts praying out loud. Where I grew up, you know, there was a very polite invocation and maybe a prayer over the offering and a benediction from time to time, a pastoral prayer. But here they had this mighty prayer, and the pastor would start praying out loud, and members of the congregation would typically kind of kneel down facing their chairs, and then they would start to pray. And so it would become this great cacophony of spoken out loud prayer with the pastor and all the members, the men and the women and the children praying out loud together. And, it stretched my understanding of what kind of dignified worship was supposed to be like, because it was a little bit chaotic and a little bit, kind of wild. But I knew that there was more to worship in our church from a pretty young age from being there. And then, you know, years later, I never would have imagined that I would have the chance to go and worship with people in Haiti. But that Haiti now, I have this interesting field, as a Community of Christ apostle. So I'm assigned to a certain part of the world. So my field is Canada, Haiti, and Mexico. And so I get to go to Haiti now with some regularity. And it is, we have about 180 congregations in Haiti, some rural ones, some urban ones, some of them are quite large. So, you know, if you're at the Ash congregation, they have some of the most amazing choirs that I have ever heard anywhere. They are fabulous singers, and music is a big part of worship in Haiti. We had from time to time in Ottawa growing up a little bit of a choir, but here these people are professional singers almost. Worship is also in Haiti, I would say, is much more vibrant in their, you know, the preaching tends to be kind of a call and response type of thing, where people in the congregation will interact with shouting amens or kind of expressing their enthusiasm for ideas that the preacher has shared, which I often find myself wondering what it feels like when we've had, you know, Haitians who will come here to World Conference and sit as a guest in a worship service in a congregation here in the Midwestern U.S., where people tend to be much more reserved in their response. And, I think it's hard to even make sense of how different it is in some ways, just because the energy is so different. You've got to be, I think if you're raised here, you recognize the movement, those subtle movements of the spirit that are beautiful and powerful. But in Haiti, people are much more used to vocalizing their feeling of the movement of the spirit. So it's different.
So what does it look like when you worship in Haiti? Give us an idea of what our visual experience would be.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was just in Haiti for the Haiti Great North Mission Center Conference. And I would say one of the first ways it looks is a lot more crowded. So people are packed in to, oftentimes just packed into our congregations. I talk about, you know, telling people how big some of our buildings are, you know, well, a way to talk about, God, I'm not good at telling you the dimensions, but how many people fit, you know? And I say, well, this is a building that would fit, about 200 people, kind of US Canada style. So we had like 450 people there Haitian style, because they crowd in. And we were there for the Mission Center Conference. We had, you know, in addition to all of the guest pastors and leaders from all around the Mission Center who were crowded onto the rostrum, we had two or three choirs crowded onto the rostrum. And so we were just literally a couple of times I would stand up to go sneak a picture, and if you stand up, you risk losing your seat because someone is probably looking for a place to sit, because it's just that kind of, that kind of crazy, crowded, hot, sweaty. Yes, that's the other thing. It looks sweaty because there's no air conditioning and it's crowded and it's hot. And so you've got fans going everywhere as people are trying to keep cool. But lots of singing, vibrant preaching, call and response, worship services that last, not a polite 1 hour, but maybe that go on for a couple of hours, I would say would be the kind of the standard length. And then if it's a special service or there are lots of things going on, it may extend for 3 or 4 hours.
So in Haiti, have you experienced services where the sacraments are part of the worship experience? And how is that either alike or different than how people might experience that in the U.S. or Canada or other places?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember reading when I was in Tahiti years ago and teaching classes on the sacraments, one of our manuals was recommending that if there was going to be a sacrament, like a baptism or a baby blessing incorporated into the service, that should be the focal point of the service, that the whole service should be dedicated to that sacrament. And I remember just laughing because, in a place where the church is growing rapidly and where there are lots of baptisms and baby blessings, and, you know, it's not really realistic to say every time you have a baptism that you should dedicate the entire Sunday service to that. So when I was last in Haiti, as part of our Mission Center conference, on the Friday evening service, we baptized 60 people. So we had a baptismal service. They had a big swimming pool set up on the side of the rostrum, and we had three priesthood members in the swimming pool, and people, you know, once that baptismal moment of the service started, people just started coming in, and they would baptize someone. They kind of went each person just kept baptizing people until they were all done. The congregation was singing, the choirs were singing. It was a little bit chaotic, but beautiful. And there was really a wonderful spirit there. But yes, much different than where, you know, some places where, well, I had never been to a baptism service where we baptized 60 people, in the Ottawa congregation where I was growing up. And I don't think it would be very common in many of our congregations in the United States. But so lots of sacraments being celebrated all the time. It's a big, vibrant church. And that means there are lots of sacraments.
A lot going on. So you've also traveled extensively in Central and South America. I know we talked a little bit about your experience in Honduras and what the church looks and sounds like there. So can you share a little bit of that with us?
Yeah, we've got about 30-some congregations in Honduras, and some of them really, again, small rural congregations, and some bigger urban congregations in San Pedro Sula and Tegucigalpa. It's, you know, there's really a kind of an evangelical Pentecostal type influence that is never far away from the church in Honduras. And it's fascinating to see how, you know, when I first went there and didn't speak Spanish very much at all at the beginning, you look at some of the style and it feels almost like, oh, I remember thinking, is this Community of Christ? You know, in what ways is this Community of Christ? Because it seems it's kind of a more evangelical Pentecostal feeling kind of style. And as I started to learn Spanish, I started to be much more able to pick out kind of what was being preached and what was being sung. And you start to see ways in which really our enduring principles and our mission are being affirmed in this. But in Honduras, you tend to either be Catholic or evangelical. And so those evangelical and Pentecostal influences, a lot of people that come to Community of Christ are coming from, another evangelical or Pentecostal church. And so sometimes they bring kind of they've found something they love about Community of Christ, but they bring with them, pieces of their tradition. And so things pop up in interesting ways. I remember being at we were at a worship service the week where we'd had leadership training going on, and we had pastors and leaders in from all around Latin America. And so they were divided up. And I remember going with Simon Copa from Bolivia, where, you know, in Bolivia, our worship style is very sedate and calm. And we went to this worship service at the Villa Nueva Honduras congregation, just outside of San Pedro Sula. And these girls started as the singing was going on, kind of at the beginning of the worship service, they'll sing in Honduras. They sing, you might figure, you know, there'll be at least a half hour of singing, as people prepare for or enter into worship. But these young girls got up and started spinning in front of the congregation, and they were just doing kind of going, turning, spinning round and round and round and round. And I was worried about them, actually, because I'm thinking they're going to get dizzy and fall down, you know, and they did eventually fall down. But then you realized, you know, it was a bit of a ritual that had been brought over from another church. And it's always an interesting dialogue, because in Community of Christ, we don't have sort of an official way of worshiping the lines on that define the edges of what is a reasonable expression of worship in community of Christ are blurry. And so it takes a lot of kind of discernment and wisdom on the part of leaders to just kind of be in dialogue with the congregation. In this case, you know, some of those expressions that had come in from other churches have kind of gradually been, as they've dialogued a little bit about what worship means to us in community of Christ, some of those more, those charismatic type expressions that maybe didn't seem to have as much purpose in terms of forming discipleship, have tended to kind of then, drop out of the worship life of the congregation. But it's an ever evolving, interesting kind of dialogue, and
one we've been having for a long time.
Yes, I don't think we'll ever get there.
So you met your spouse when you and Laura were at, was it Kirtland or Nauvoo, the historic site?
At Nauvoo.
And so you're aware that in our history, we've had Pentecostal movements come into a community, or what was then the Latter-day Saints, and it has kind of had some influence in shaping and forming us in different ways. And yet we have drawn a distinction between vibrant worship and charismatic expressions in that way. And that has been an interesting experience for us. So because you know a bit about our history, can you make a comparison perhaps between how the Pentecostal influence of what we experienced at Kirtland and that time period in the church, and what happens in places like Honduras and others that we'll talk about? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a way it does feel like we're very much in the tradition of some of what was experienced in Kirtland in those days. You know, when you've got a rapidly growing church with new people come in with their own stories and their own experiences, and they bring that, and that enriches the life of the church. But then it's a matter of working that out together. And I think when you go back and read church history, certainly in the Kirtland years, you know, they were Joseph Smith, as the local leader of that new growing church, was in dialogue with those people trying to work that out. I think, you know, in a place like Honduras, that became, and as they continue to deal with those kinds of things, it's something probably that gets best dealt with by local leaders who are aware of the cultural dynamic in the place where they live. I, as the kind of the Canadian guest or the Bolivian guest, you know, we were not really the best positioned to make sense of that or to help people kind of journey through that particular challenge in the life of the church. But if the church is growing and, you know, thriving, we'll always be having to deal with those kinds of things. And I think, you know, there's this gene in Community of Christ of really wanting to honor the lives of the people that are coming in. So becoming part of Community of Christ isn't just a matter of, well, leave everything behind and now you do it our way. There is this element of now we are merging our journeys together, and we honor the Community of Christ tradition, but some of what that Community of Christ tradition is this ability to respect and honor others and their life journeys. So it's complicated.
It's part of what it is to live out unity and diversity.
It is.
Okay. Yeah. So while we're kind of on that subject of some of the challenges and blessings that come from this incorporating lots of traditions in community together in Community of Christ, you were talking earlier before we prepared for this about Chile and Santiago. So let's talk a little bit about that experience.
Yeah. Santiago was such an interesting place for me, because, and I know that there are quite a few maybe Project Zion listeners who are connected to the Latter-day Saint tradition. And so when I showed up as the new Mission Center president for the South America Mission Center, and we just at that time we had this brand new little emerging congregation in Santiago, and the folks there, pretty much everybody who was associated with the church at that time had come out of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints from that tradition. And they had discovered wonderful things that they loved about Community of Christ. And they were really working to, they were Community of Christ. They'd been baptized and they were, but it was interesting when I first visited their worship, I noticed some things. And I actually at that point had never really, visited, LDS, wards or been part of LDS worship. So I didn't know much about what that looked like. What I knew about it then, or what I was about to learn about it, I learned mostly from these former LDS people. And so I got the impression that LDS worship probably tended to be a sitting down, fairly sedate kind of worship. So I'd come from Brazil or Honduras, where everybody was, you know, it was this very kind of charismatic worship style, and get to Santiago, and here they were kind of sitting for the opening prayer, sitting for the opening hymn, you know, the opening hymn, sitting for the sermon, sitting, and very dignified and all of that, which was fine. I mean, it was absolutely fine.
It would have looked a lot like Ottawa when
it actually reminded me a lot of church growing up where I was. But where things started to get interesting was that this little group that, you know, had grown mostly out of, this kind of former Mormon milieu, Gustavo Vergara, who was very clever in terms of pursuing missionary opportunities. He had made friends with some people who had time on local radio stations, and then he would be able to get on some of those radio shows. And so he was preaching late at night on these radio programs. And one of the fellows that ended up hearing that radio broadcast became intrigued about this different kind of church that had just started in Chile. And when he heard that they were going to build their first building, right around the corner, you know, just like literally like three blocks from where he lived, this is a guy that had been involved in the early days of Christian radio in Chile, and an old Pentecostal. And he would sing some of those old Pentecostal hymns, was involved in a Pentecostal ministry, but had gotten into conflict over a number of things in Chile, some of them related to the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet and the Protestant church's support of Pinochet, but some of those things a little more personal. He had kind of walked away from church activity and had sort of said, I'm staying home, I'm done with this. But then he starts hearing Gustavo preaching on the radio about this new kind of church. And then it turns out that they're building this new church right around the corner from where he lives. And he's like, it's a sign from God. I need to go check these people out. So he goes in there, and this little group, of course, who have very much an evangelistic, a missionary spirit, they're looking for new people. They're glad that he's there. And it turns out he's musical. So they're delighted. And they ask him, oh, could you lead some songs? So he's sitting in front of the congregation with his guitar kind of perched on his lap, you know, but he really, you know, that goes on for a little while, a few weeks, but eventually he's like, this song we really need to stand for. I think we should stand for this song. And then it was, this song, you really need to just put your hands in the air. And, you know, and there was one particular member of the congregation that literally threw his songbook on the floor in protest at this outrage, because this was not the way worship was supposed to be. And this little congregation in Santiago went into kind of just self-destruct mode in terms of struggling with each other about the appropriate limits of worship. And, you know, as long as it was just this one little group that they were all sitting down and they were all kind of in agreement with that, and that was fine, because in Community of Christ, we don't have a set way to worship exactly. At least it's it's complicated, but they were okay. They were within those limits. But as they started trying to deal with the complexity of having this new Pentecostal background guy who also, just like them, had found some things that he loved about the identity and mission of Community of Christ, but figuring out the practicalities of, so how are we going to worship together every week, was challenging. And that's a challenge that we live out all around the church.
In lots of places.
In lots of places.
We've had those conversations. Absolutely. So in the different places where you've traveled and participated in worship, and I would assume led worship or been an important part of what happened in the worship experience, can you tell us a little bit about the role of women in worship in the places you've been? Here in the U.S., where we are, women have been an important part of worship behind the scenes for decades. Yeah. But after the change to ordain women, that really shifted the role of women in the worship environment and the worship experience. So can you share with us a little bit about the role, particularly of women, in the places you've been?
Yeah, it's been a really important marker of what it means. It's become a really important marker of what it means to be Community of Christ. So having women and men leading in clergy-type roles, kind of leading the church, is a very significant marker of what it means to be Community of Christ in a lot of places. For a while, you know, and well, talking about Honduras, in some ways, so here we were kind of looking like a lot of other churches in some ways, but the dominant culture would have had primarily men leading these congregations. And for, I'm not as involved in Honduras right now, so this isn't right current information, but at one point, I know the pastor of our biggest four biggest congregations in Honduras, three would have been pastored by women. Mm-hmm. So that makes things different and people notice, you know, it's the kind of thing that, you know, you walk by this interesting, looks maybe a lot like a lot of other church kind of facades in Tegucigalpa, Honduras, poke your head in the door and the pastor is a woman. Oh, well, that's interesting. And it says something about our enduring principles of the worth of all persons and other things too. I remember sitting in, you know, in some places, so in Honduras, there are women pastors in other churches, you know, but then there are places like when we lived in Tahiti for several years, at that time, we were the only church that had women ordained as leaders. So there wasn't a great religious diversity in terms of denominations in Tahiti. There was the Catholic Church. There was kind of this, what they called l'Église protestante, which was an expression of kind of a Protestant denomination. And then they were just starting with, they had, the LDS Church, as well as the Seventh-day Adventists, Jehovah's Witnesses. Anyway, we were the only church that really had that were actively ordaining women. I remember sitting in a funeral service one time on the front row of in the church, and the leader of the Protestant church. So this fellow was the leader of the church that represented probably about 40% of all Tahitians. Mm-hmm. And he's sitting there next to me, and Mareva Arnaud, who's now in the Council of 12, for the Community of Christ, but Mareva Arnaud was presiding over this communion service. And the leader of the Protestant church leans over to me and says, "Where on earth do you find all these amazingly gifted women leaders?" We didn't have a chance to have a long conversation. Yeah. It was a funeral, but yeah, it's one of the very important markers of who we are, that women and men share together in leadership. In some places, like in Haiti, it's been a struggle. So because the tradition there was really strongly established with men in the core leadership roles, and women would serve as deaconesses and, you know, maybe in a couple of different roles. And that, I would say, only really in the last 10 years is that starting to really change. where women are becoming more involved in the various priesthood offices of the church. It's pretty exciting to get to watch.
What about the participation of children? A lot of our listeners still have kids at home, young kids at home, and many of us are grandparents of kids or have teenagers. What does the participation of children look like as you've traveled? Have you seen, is there a difference maybe than how it is in the U.S. and Canada?
So I think kids are often pretty involved. A lot of times kids get involved in the music ministry of the church, which, you know, and I think about, in Honduras, music is such an important part. You know, a lot of our congregations would have a band, you know, that, or at least a few different instruments, you know, someone to play guitar and someone to play drums. And so a lot of times you see the kids getting involved in through a musical instrument, but then that is really a way into worship, leadership, and worship ministry because, I remember that when the San Pedro Sula congregation was, they actually contracted with a group to come in and teach them how to have a band. And so all the kids learned all these different instruments. And within like a year, they went from not knowing how to play instruments to having this full worship band going. But the person who was teaching them was really helping them to understand that it wasn't as much about learning an instrument as it was learning how to lead worship. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's really porous between the line between leading through an instrument and then those kids get involved in learning how to lead in other aspects of worship. And certainly in Latin America, they've got an active, youth camping program where, you know, kids and young people and young adults share together in youth camp every year and they plan their own activities and they lead their own worship. So the kids learn how to, not just to, you know, come and sit on a pew or in a bench in a sanctuary during worship, but they learn to be involved in offering public ministry, prayers and testimonies, sharing stories about how God is involved in their lives. And it seems like in so many places, one of the interesting things about Community of Christ is we have this really collaborative shared leadership and worship. And so I know for me, growing up, you know, I was maybe kind of a shy kid and not the kind of person who would love, I probably wouldn't have tended towards wanting to be up front or speaking in a microphone, you know, but I learned to do that at church and I learned to overcome a lot of my timidness and fears, about that kind of public speaking. And so it was helpful for me in life, but yeah, I think generally in Community of Christ, that idea of helping kids to develop that way has been really an important part of who we are. And it's been fun to hear stories about, you know, some folks even, engaging newly with Community of Christ in some pretty small congregations and wondering what this would be like and learning that, yeah, there's really a place for their kids, because people are really anxious to involve kids in sharing with the congregation. So,
well, it's part of our generosity, isn't it? When we,
I think that's a neat way of looking at it. Yeah.
So, you've had opportunity to be in a lot of places. Do you have any moments that stick out as maybe the funniest or the oddest thing that happened during a worship service? I know oftentimes when full-time ministers get together in retreat setting, we start telling tales of all of the missteps we've made in worship in other cultures. So can you think of anything just off the top of your head that was unusual?
You know, I remember I was with Rick Maupin and Johnny Stobno and Dave Shaw. Rick was in the Council of 12. Dave Shaw was a member of the First Presidency, and we traveled to Haiti for the ordination of two high priests in Haiti. And we're at the Pétionville congregation, so the church was packed with probably 800 to 1,000 people, and they had guest choirs who were there. And so some of those choirs were from other really Pentecostal churches. And as it happened, the night before, everybody in our group, except for me, I have a gut that apparently is pretty much made of iron, but everybody else in our little delegation from the United States got really sick from probably something that we had eaten. And so Johnny Stavno didn't even make it out of bed that next morning, but Rick and Dave Shaw and I stumbled out to, well, Dave Shaw and Rick kind of stumbled out the door, and away we went to the worship service. And Dave preached the sermon that morning. I translated for him. And then we got to these two ordinations that we were going to do. And Dave Shaw had the prayer for the first ordination with Rick assisting. And then Rick had the second prayer with Dave Shaw assisting. And I was translating the prayers so that people could understand the prayers that were taking place in English. And I remember Dave had finished, I think, with his preaching and finished with his prayer, and the adrenaline was kind of running out that had been keeping this sick man going through that service to that point. And I'm looking over at him. He's got his hands on the head of the person that he's assisting to ordain, and his hands are starting to kind of just massage the scalp of the person. I'm thinking, that's odd. And then I realize that he's about to lose consciousness. So he's kind of going to faint. And so I'm translating, and Rick is praying this prayer. And of course, he's got his eyes closed, and he is praying. And I'm thinking, okay, Rick, wrap it up. And, and I managed to kind of signal to someone who was paying attention, to grab a chair, and they brought a chair down. And, you know, eventually, Rick kind of finished his prayer, and Dave Shaw collapsed into this chair that was sitting there for him. But it was funny because I remember as one of the women in the choir from one of these other churches, from her perspective, this was a clear manifestation of the spirit, you know, that this person was being kind of slain in the spirit or something. And she started to kind of howl, and then the whole choir kind of erupted into loud kind of howling, and, it was an interesting morning at Petionville.
It sounds like it. Right. So with all your experiences, where do you feel most at home in worship?
You know, that is an impossible to answer question. There are so many just different places and ways. There are a lot of places. I think people would think that guy is very strange, because I feel very much at home in Poá, Brazil, where people have their hands in the air and they are very animated in their worship style. You know, at one point when I was a kid, and even my early years going down there, it just felt, I couldn't do that. You know, it just felt so strange, but now that is home for me. But I can slide into a pew in an older traditional style congregation that feels a lot like where I grew up, and that is home to me too. I'm a little bit mixed up. So what is just really home for me? I have multiple homes. And luckily in this community that I'm in love with, all of those homes are provided. So it's kind of nice.
Well, if that's mixed up, I think that's a good way to be mixed up. So from growing up in Ottawa to where we are now, and I know you said that Eric's away at college and your daughter Tiona is going to be 11. What do you hope that Eric and Tiona experience in worship as they grow into adulthood?
So I think what I'm always hoping for them is that they'll have a chance to explore their own spirituality, that they will be able to experience a little bit, well, to explore kind of the mystical side of their beings, but also to find to find an experience that reinforces their own sense of call to be disciples of Jesus. So, you know, worship does so many different things for us and for different people. I hope that they're able to find something that authentically feeds them and calls them forward to deeper spirituality and deeper discipleship.
Well, I want to thank you, Art, for coming to talk with us a little bit about worship today. I appreciate that very much, that you would spend this time with us. So we're going to close with just a little paragraph from William Willimon, and it's from a book he wrote called Pastor, The Theology and Practice of Ordained Ministry. And here's what Willimon offers us about worship. We worship God not for utilitarian or pragmatic purposes, but rather because we have been loved. God, being God, is to be adored, not used. We do not worship God in order to get things from God, though in worship we often experience the grace of God in ways too wonderful for words. But worship is a way of being in love. And I hope that this podcast expresses that through the audio that I've watched on your face as we've shared. So thank you.
Thanks, Karen.
Again, this is Common Grounds. I'm Karen Peter. We're part of the Project Zion podcast, and we'll be sharing more about worship and community of Christ as we experience ordinary time together. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.